Dr. Fossett tells me that some were late because they had a Greek exam. Well, I told him he should scold whoever gave the Greek exam for holding people late. He said, well, I gave the Greek exam. Well, we all make mistakes once in a while, so I won't hold it against you. Now, the first paper that I see here, I'm not going to discuss the even-numbered question because it was simply a giving back to me of material given yesterday. That is, three arguments we discussed. If you could simply state one of the three, that's all I ask. Now, on later occasions, we may ask for all three. But the question asked of the odd-numbered students was a question to show how well you have put together what has been given. It has not been answered specifically in class, but all the material has been given with which you could answer. According to the supplementary theory, what is the oldest part of the penis? I look at the first paper that I see here, and it says, E document is original. That's the first sentence. E document is original. Now that, I think, is a very good summary of, it's not enough, but in itself, at the first sentence of what's given here, it is a good summary. The supplementary theory held there was one document written first, supplements added later. Well, it's very important we know which document they thought it was. And I believe I made perfectly clear that what they thought it was the E document. Well, now, of course, you just say E document, that's not enough. We want to know what you mean by E document. Let's see what it says. It says that this is the part that uses the name God rather than the name Jehovah. That's what the E word E means. It is the one which uses Elohim. This is a very good answer thus far. From here on, it does not deal with the matter that I had asked. Now let's look at another paper and see what we find. Here is one which I don't know that I can read, but I'll try. It says the oldest part, according to the supplementary theory, would be the first chapter of Genesis up through 2-3, E document. Now that, you see, has the excellence of the first paper I looked at with an added equal excellence that it names the chapters I asked you to. At least one chapter. Well, I haven't named many chapters, but one I have stressed is that according to the original documentary theory, you had one document containing chapters 1-1 to 2-3, and you had a second document using the word Lord starting at 2-4 and running on, and then these two interlaced. And so that is a very important part of the answer. It is the first chapter of Genesis up through verse 2-3, the E document. And let's see, what else? It does not have the other very vital part of the answer. It is, according to the supplementary theory, the whole Pentateuch, or at least the first four books of the Pentateuch, were made up of an original document plus certain supplements. That original document, according to the supplementary theory, consists of the first chapter of Genesis and those other portions of the four books which are similar to the first chapter of Genesis, which belong with it by virtue of using the same name for God or by virtue of having a similar style. You see, that is a very important part of it too. That would be, now I had not discussed this particular question, I've given you all the data to enter into, but so anyone who didn't know the even number, that is very bad, it shows you didn't review yet. But anybody who didn't know the odd number, maybe with 5 minutes thought you could have brought it together and had it. But it's very important for what we discussed today, so I wanted to call our attention to it specifically, that the supplementary theory recognize the first chapter of Genesis plus those sections of the Pentateuch which are similar to it, which belong with it as part of one document. And they held that those sections could be recognized in Genesis and in the early chapters of Exodus by using the name Elohim instead of the name Jehovah. But they held that after Exodus 6:3, that after that, this foundation document, which Eichhorn had called the Edom, this foundation document after 6:3 rarely uses Elohim, but that the portions of it after 6:3 which belong to the E document can be distinguished by similarity of style to the E document. Now, if this course were a 2-year course instead of a 1-semester course, I would assign to all of you to make a list of all the Hebrew words used in Genesis 1:1-2:3. To note particularly any words that occurred 2 or 3 times in that section, and then to trace the same words through the rest of the Pentateuch, which could easily be done with a Hebrew concordance, and see whether they all occur in sections that are considered to belong to the E document, and whether none of them occur in sections supposed to belong to the J document. One of the phrases of which most attention has been called by critics is the fact that we read in Genesis 1, God created man, male and female created he them. While Genesis 2 says the man and his wife. And so they say male and female is a phrase typical of the E document. Man and his wife is typical of the J document. Now, it is easy to get from almost any book written by the critics a list of those passages which they consider to be E documents and those which they consider to be J documents. And you could take that phrase and see, does male and female, whenever it occurs, always occur in something they think is part of the E document? Does man and wife, wherever it occurs, always occur in something that they consider part of the J document? And we'll have to admit that if each of these terms occurs 12 times in the Pentateuch, and the 12 times that they occur, that one occurs, are always in passages in Genesis which use the word God, or in passages in the rest of the Pentateuch which they consider belong to the E document, and the other one occurs 12 times, and always occurs in Genesis in passages that use the word Lord, and always occurs in rest of the Pentateuch in passages they feel belong with those passages that use Lord. If it does that, you've got a good strong argument for the critical theory at this point. But if you find a number of cases, as you do, where the phrase will be used in the passage that they give to the other writer, and then in their writing, in their commentaries, you find a footnote and say, here the redactor changed the text and used the phrase that doesn't belong here. Or if you find that they only occur 2 or 3 times, that's not enough to prove anything anyway. So you see the method of approach, which would be a fair scientific method of checking their claim. Yes, mister? Yes, ma'am. Mr. Varr has put his finger on a point of ambiguity which is unavoidable at this point in the development. That is to say, this which I have just been stating would apply equally to Eichhorn's theory, except that he did not say which was early. But to the division, it would apply equally to his. It would apply equally to the supplementary theory, which takes the same division Eichhorn made, but calls part of it the foundation ready and part of it the supplement. And as to how well it will apply to later theories, we must wait till we get to that. Yeah. But the method of approach, the type of argument, is equally true in all. But as to the later theories, that is extremely important. But I want to have this part very clear, or you won't get anything out of the other. I remember about 30 years ago, there was a senior who had this course and failed the final exam. And I gave him a 65, which means he can take a makeup exam. And so he took up a makeup exam. And in that makeup exam, I asked, describe the J document as fully, its characteristics. And he gave a most, he said, the J document is, and he gave a most accurate, clear, precise presentation of the quality which the critics assert belonged to the Jason, to the Edom, but he said it was the Jason. And the result was he came back the next year for another year before he graduated. Because though he knew all the points, if he didn't know the main thing of which document they referred to, it was an utter waste of time. And so he took the course over again the next fall, and we graduated him a year later. But you see, the trouble was he did not have this foundation part we're dealing with now. So he got a lot of later material well in mind, but it didn't mean anything. It was an utter waste. It was utterly valueless. As if you were to start to tell somebody what the United States is like and you gave them a beautiful description of Switzerland. It would be, you might give a fine description of Switzerland, but if you said it was the United States, it would be worse than useless. And so to know specifically the difference between these is extremely important if you're going to understand any of the very important and extensive material we look at further on. But at this point, we are interested in seeing the development of the theory, and there are some very vital things that I want you to get very thoroughly in mind in connection with. We're looking at D, the supplement hypothesis. We notice its long ascendance, and we notice that it had certain great weaknesses which came more and more to be recognized. We notice how Colenso had a certain amount of influence in destroying the supplementary theory through the attack which he made upon the credibility and the dependability of the very section the critics were saying was the earliest. He was attacking things he thought were erroneous in the Pentateuch, but these things he was attacking weren't in the late document, as they called it, the J, the late supplement, which was the same as what the others called the J document, but was in the very foundation writing itself, which Eichhorn had called the E document. And then we mention as capital E the crystallization hypothesis. Now, the crystallization hypothesis, which Ewald proposed in 1843, is not of any great importance to us because it did not win any wide acceptance. It is of importance to us simply because it showed the recognition of the difficulties in the supplement theory. Now, if this piece of chalk here, I think I can maybe illustrate. Do you know where it would be, Mike? Well, I don't want to miss any of it. I'd rather nobody went for any. Here's a little piece. Yep. Yeah, here's one. Thank you. According to the supplement theory, you have sections here, which we call the foundation writing. Then we have these sections. We're all continuous. One book written at one time. Then the supplementer inserts something here. And something here, and something here, and so on. And so he makes these insertions. And in many of these insertions, you find that something is assumed, which is already mentioned here. Something may be assumed here, which is already mentioned here. And thus, in order to understand these supplements, you will have to recognize certain things that they don't tell you about, that were already told here. Well, now, Ewald said, in addition to that, you will find things that discuss here that you don't understand without something up there. You'll find something that's discussed here that isn't explained here at all, but was explained up there. And so he said, the relations go both ways. And therefore, he said, it must be there wasn't one supplement, but a series of supplements. So he said, what happened was probably that here is the writing, which used the name E for God. And in this writing, which used the name E for God, somebody supplemented and they added something. And this assumed certain things here. This assumed certain things here. And this one over here assumed certain things mentioned back here and so on. And so you get supplements added to this. And now you have one continuous document, including this. But then, this one down here used the name E for God. This one used the name Jehovah. Now, another supplementer comes over.
And this other supplementer adds further sections which use the term each. And these have certain assumptions. They rest back on whether it's on either this or this. And this one has assumptions that rest back on that or that. And so on. And then another supplementer comes along and he adds J material, which has assumptions that rest back on this or this, and so on. You see, the crystallization theory is a series of supplements.
Well, now that was an attempt to overcome the difficulties of the supplement theory by extending the same idea further. But it makes it far more complicated, as you can see. And it did not win approval. So it probably would be forgotten if it were not for the great name of Ewald connected with it, the man who had done so much as a young man to destroy the fragment theory, with showing the many interrelations between parts in the book of Genesis, and thus had laid so much the foundation for the establishment of the supplement theory. But the crystallization hypothesis is not in itself of importance because it won very few adherents. And 9 years afterwards, another theory was advanced, which at first won very few adherents either, but which eventually came to be universally accepted. And so it is of great importance to us, and we call it, capital F, Hupfeld theory. And H-U-P-F-E-L-D, Hupfeld theory. Yes, Mr. Dr. Sosa?
You mentioned that he was the one
that said
that
Calenso is J, but also E, but also E. No. No, Calenso said there were unhistorical matters, impossible matters. It couldn't have been proved in E. But what Ewald said was there are that J assumes parts of E, and therefore those parts of E that then E assumes parts of J. And therefore, those parts of E that assume parts of J aren't part of the original E at all, but represent another supplementer added after the first J supplement.
But actually,
Ewald
evolved the crystallization hypothesis
because of the crystallization. Ewald, in 1823, gave the death blow to the fragment theory by showing interrelation, which led other scholars to advance the supplement theory. Ewald probably accepted the supplement theory, but was not satisfied with it, didn't feel it fully answered the difficulty. Then he thought the answers could be, difficulties could be answered by carrying the supplement theory a bit further in the crystallization theory, but others didn't follow him in that. Hupfeld was not followed either at first, though he was by some. But eventually, Hupfeld's theory was adopted and is accepted to this day. So Hupfeld, therefore, is of tremendous importance in the history of the critical theory. You may completely forget the crystallization theory, but please remember the date when Hupfeld wrote his book presenting his theory. And that date should not be a hard one to remember, because if you remember that Astruc wrote his book, which is the first book that became widely known at all, about the division into documents on the basis of divine names in 1753. It is then easy to remember that Hupfeld wrote exactly 100 years later, in 1853. On the other hand, if you don't remember when Astruc wrote, why, it's just 100 years before Hupfeld wrote, you see. So Astruc is 1753 and Hupfeld is 1853. Now, in 1853, Hupfeld presented what has been called the modified document hypothesis. The modified document hypothesis. The document theory of Eisfeld had been given up, you see. First, by the fragmentary theory. Then, to a far greater extent, by the supplement hypothesis. But the modified document theory said no, it said there is no supplementation. There are separate documents, just as originally had been said by Eichhorn. But here comes an extremely interesting thing. Eichhorn has said, look at the E document, the similarities in style all the way through. Now, nobody can help recognizing there is a difference in style between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Nobody can read those two chapters without saying there is a difference in style between them. Now, one man can write in several styles. The difference of style does not necessarily show a difference of authorship. If a man writes in several styles, there have to be points of similar between these styles. You might be able to recognize they're from the same writer, but yet they can be quite different styles. One day, Queen Victoria at her court received a very learned gentleman, the Reverend Mr. Dodgson, who had written Alice in Wonderland. And Queen Victoria told him how fascinated she was with his children's book, Alice in Wonderland. And she said, have you written something else? If you have, I wish you would send me a copy of it. And he said, Your Majesty, I will be very glad to do so. And 5 days later, the mail brought her a copy of a very erudite treatise on higher mathematics by the Reverend Mr. Dodgson, one of the leading mathematical researchers of the British Isles. Well, now, anybody looking at these two books, looking at Alice in Wonderland and looking at this treatise on higher mathematics, would say, what an utterly different style. The children that loved Alice in Wonderland could not understand two lines of the book on higher mathematics. But the mathematician who could understand the higher mathematics could look at Alice in Wonderland and see that underneath all the clever, almost childish presentation of Alice in Wonderland, there is a very, very subtle presentation of some very profound points which might be considered philosophical or mathematical. Alice in Wonderland is not just a simple children's thing. It is a presentation of very, very advanced ideas in an extremely simple way. But he didn't use any such simple style when he wrote his treatise on mathematics. So the fact there's a different style may or may not prove a different author. But you must recognize there's a different style between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Genesis 1, the Lord said, let us do so-and-so. And he did so-and-so. And he looked at what he had seen, and it was good. And there was evening and morning, thus such and such a day. And then the Lord said, let us do so-and-so. And the Lord did so-and-so. And he saw what he had done, and it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, thus such and such a day. Well, now that repetition is not carried through completely. But there is a tremendous repetition in Genesis 1. You have the feeling almost as if you are looking at a table. You're looking at a tabular presentation of facts in Genesis 1. And then you look over at Genesis 2, and you find God doing something and saying something, and the man saying something, and certain events occurring. You have a very fine, flowing narrative style in Genesis 2, which is very different from this tabular, almost statistical type of presentation which you have in Genesis 1. And so wherever you find a statistical table, or in most cases where you find a statistical table, how many years so-and-so lived, and he died, and his sons, he had sons and daughters, and then so-and-so was so old when he begat the firstborn, and he had sons and daughters, and he was so old when he died. And then the next one, you find many sections like that in Genesis and in other parts of the Pentateuch, and it is quite natural to say how similar the style of these is to the style of Genesis 1. And it so happens that most such passages have no name for God in them at all. So on the basis of whether they say God or Lord, you could not often take any such passage and say whether it belongs to the J document or the E document. But on the basis of the type of style, genealogical, statistical, tabular, something like that, you can say these sections belong with Genesis 1. And so that is one of the great characteristics of the E document, while the J document is more of a narrative presentation. Well, now, Hupfeld produced a most astonishing thing. Subsequent scholars have found that what Hupfeld produced had already been suggested by Ilgen back in 1798. And so they today are apt to praise Ilgen as the really one of the great founders of the documentary theory. But Ilgen, in my opinion, was one of the founders of the fragmentary theory. He suggested a new way of division, and others didn't follow him, but they suggested other ways of division. They broke it all up to fragments. And then they asked Ilgen to come to Berlin as professor of Old Testament. He says, I quit working in the Old Testament. I'm going into the field of education. And he became quite an outstanding authority in the field of education and left the field of biblical study altogether. But 60 years later, the suggestion Hupfeld made was substantially the same as what Ilgen had made 60 years earlier. But Hupfeld's suggestion was accepted and is held by all critical scholars today. And so it is of tremendous importance to us. Now the thing that was most apparent to people about Hupfeld's theory was that he was abandoning the supplement idea and going back to the old document theory. And that, of course, seemed to many of them to be a step backwards. But the vital thing is not that. The vital thing is this, that Hupfeld said, from about Genesis 20 on, through the rest of Genesis, he said the sections there of the E document are actually so similar in style to the J document that it would be practically impossible to separate them out if it were not for the different name of God. In other words, before that they said the style of Genesis 1 is characteristic of the E document all the way through. Now Ilgen takes all of Genesis 1 from all of Genesis, not all, but most of the E document from Genesis 20 on and says this is not similar in style to Genesis 1 at all, but it is so similar to Genesis 2 and to the rest of the J document that you couldn't even separate if it were not for the names of God. So Hupfeld said, there is not only an Elohim, that's the name they use for the man who used the name Elohim as he wrote. They call him the Elohim, E-L-O-H-I-S-T. But there is a second Elohim. And the first Elohim writes the E material from Genesis 1 to Genesis 20, and most of it in the rest of the Pentateuch. While the second Elohim writes most of the E material from Genesis 20 on. Now you see what a tremendous difference this makes in the whole thing. Now we're leaving Deuteronomy aside altogether for the present. In the first four books of the Pentateuch, we now have not two documents, but three documents. We have a first Elohim, we have a second Elohim, and we have the Jehovah. And the second Elohim, instead of being so similar to the first Elohim that everybody thinks they're one document, is so similar to the Jehovah and so different from the first Elohim that we say it is a different document altogether. And we say in many cases we can't be sure what belongs to the second Elohim or J. But between the first Elohim and the second Elohim, or between the first Elohim and J, we can always be sure. You see what a marked change that is, and you see what questions that raises about the logic and the insight of the people who before were so sure that the whole E document was one style and the whole J document a very different style. When you take all this out of the E document and say it's so similar, the J document can't tell it apart and utterly different from the rest of the E document. Now this is a tremendously important thing, and I'm very anxious you get it exact. Yes? Yeah. Now the first Elohim and the second Elohim together make up the original E document, which Eichhorn presents. The original E document is now divided in two, the first Elohim and the second Elohim. All the material, practically, and according to some writers also, that belongs to the second Eloah comes from Genesis 20 on. Some will find a little in 15 or even a tiny bit in 13, but others will say there isn't any before 20. But from Genesis 20 on, 9/10 of them appear. That previously was said to be part of the E doctrine is considered to be part of the second Eloah, not the first. And that is therefore put over with the J document as far as style is concerned. So now, as far as Genesis is concerned, you have three documents. The first Elohim, the second Elohim, and the J document. And in later discussion, the terminology was changed so that today nobody speaks of a first Elohim and the second Elohim. But today the term E is applied only and exclusively to the second Elohim. And that is very important. The term E is only applied to the second Elohim, not to the first Elohim. And the first Elohim has been given various terms. Some have called it the priestly document. Wellhausen called it the Q document, because from the Latin quatuor, because it contained the four covenants. There have been different names given to it, but within a few years, the custom was adopted of calling it the P document for priesthood. And so today, you will find that any book on the critical theory speaks a great deal about the P document. And when it speaks of the P document, it means what Hupfeld called the first Elohim. And when it speaks of the E document, it means what Hupfeld called the second Elohim. Now, I hope that's clear. The second Elohim. What Hupfeld called the second Elohim, they today call E, and simply call it the Elohim. Yes? Genesis 1 would be P, according to present terminology. Genesis 1 would then be called P according to present terminology, which didn't start till about 1890. Yes?
Was Hilton the one that
made the statement that the second Genesis 29 are so close to the J document that it's almost impossible to change the use of Elohim? That was, well, just who made that, I couldn't say. But that was agreed by all of the critics after, say, 1880 or so. After, say, then they agree on it. Whether Ilgin actually said that, whether Hupfeld actually said that, I couldn't say. But that is the general purport of what they taught at least. Ilgin said, look at this E document. That's not one document, that's two documents. And nobody paid attention to Ilgin, but when Hupfeld said, Hupfeld had a greater name than Ilgin, and a few people paid attention to him, but it's about 15 years later that it came to be widely adopted. As a result of other circuits, as we must look at later. Yes? No. According to this, the first Elohim and G and J are mixed in Genesis 1 to 20. And the second Elohim and J are mixed from Genesis 20 on. Yes?
Elohim,
did you say he was the founder of the Einsteinian theory of theology?
He said,
yeah, it was a start in that direction. That's all.
That's all he did.
That's all he did. Then he quit the field of theology and went into education. Yes? Well, that, no. They use other divine names occasionally, but rarely. Not 1/20th as often as they use these names. Well, now that we have a whole discussion later on the question of how valid is the argument from divine names. I don't want to get into that now. According to their theory, a characteristic by which E and J can be distinguished is that E uses Elohim and J uses Jehovah. And one of the characteristics by which P and J can be distinguished is that P uses Elohim and J uses Jehovah. Yes, that is right. That is a very outstanding and important part of the theory. But now I'm not saying they say that either of them never uses the other name. I'm not saying that. But if they do, they have a problem if they find it. They say that this is the character, a characteristic. Yes, Mr. Shumi? No. Not at this point. Yeah. Most of them would say J.K. Matthews. They were pretty well used to that idea from the supplement theory. Pretty well used to the idea that J.K. Matthews. But you see, there are two, as I mentioned some time ago, there are two different forces developed separately. One is development theory, the other is document theory. It was when these two got united in 1878 that the big push came that caused the theory to become widely held. Now, we're not looking at the development theory now. According to the document theory, it's interesting to think which might be first, which might be second, but the vital thing is, how do we divide it? That's the question, rather than what is the agent. Development is interested in that. Yes? Oh, no. Oh, completely, yeah, completely, because see, Genesis 1 deals with events before the life of Moses. But once you extend it beyond Genesis 1, you wouldn't expect Moses to compile contradictory documents dealing with his own lifetime. Yeah, there he would know one or other statement was true and keep to that. So it must be later, once you extend it beyond Genesis. There's nothing wrong in advancing it as a hypothesis with regard to Genesis. There's a great deal wrong with speaking dogmatically about it as Genesis without clear proof. But once you extend it beyond Genesis into the others, then you immediately get into a position where it is impossible to consider Moses did it, and it involves contradictions and opposing views combined together by somebody later who didn't realize the opposite. Mr. Lee? Well, most of these men we've mentioned did. Most of these men we've mentioned did reject Mosaic authorship. But the thing that catches people today isn't proof as to whether Moses wrote it or not, because after all, we believe that Jesus Christ said Moses wrote it, and therefore we believe Moses wrote it. But there's no other way we could prove Moses wrote it. But if you can prove that it's divided into separate things that came together contradicting each other, that automatically disposes of the idea of Mosaic authorship. So our big problem now is not, is it by Moses, I mean in this course, but is it true? And was it, when was it written? Those are the things we're interested in now, in this particular course. Yes?
Earlier, some of the men
held
a pretty high view of this.
Oh, yes.
Now, have we gotten all too far? Many men might do not claim that Moses wrote it, but they also now do not have a high view of history.
Yeah, most of them do not. There were other men at this time who were asserting that Moses wrote it and that it's all true, strongly arguing in that direction, and having much more argument with the mass of people than these men did. But these men were exerting the influence among the scholars. And when eventually they won the scholarly world over to their view, even though the great mass of the popular people didn't believe it then, the scholars had control of the education of the next generation. And so, once they had the whole scholarly world convinced of it practically, it just carried like through rapidly. But it took a long time to convince the scholarly world and to bring them to a unanimity, because they had strong opponents of it during this period. But what we're interested in now is not the history of thought during this period, which we could take months on, and I would find it extremely interesting to do. But the thing that is vital for us to do is to get an idea. What is helpful in understanding the attitude today and how it can be answered from a reasonable viewpoint? And I don't think we fully understand it unless we have a clear understanding of how it developed. And to me, it is a tremendous point in this question of how well you recognize the difference of style between these documents. To see that for 50 years, all the critical scholars held, here's the A document and the J document, utterly in style. And then they decide that a third or half of what they previously thought was the E document actually differs so much from the rest of the E document, it's much more like the J document. And the whole scholarly world becomes convinced of that, you see. And that, to my mind, casts doubt on the validity of the whole prophecy. And that, I think, is very vital for us to have in mind. I don't want to get into other subjects now. Anything right on this subject I'd like to take time for, but we must move more faster. There are many other subjects of tremendous importance we'll take up later in the semester. But anything on another subject, please don't raise. But on this subject, if you have something, Mr. Eisenbach. That we're not in D now. Please don't mention D at all. The book of Deuteronomy we're not talking about now. We're talking about Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers at present. Numbers we have not yet spoken of. Deuteronomy we have not yet spoken of. That is another area. I want to get these basic concepts across without getting into sidelines that will confuse people at the moment. Because this is a very involved thing, but if you don't understand it, all you can do is get up and make faces at the liberals and say you're ignoramuses. And they can make faces at you and say you don't know anything. But if you can learn something about the basic principles, then you're in a position to point out what's really important about it. And there are so many other areas that are very important and we'll touch on during the course. But I don't want to get into now, or we just confuse you on this area. But we want to move on rapidly to capital 4. Roman numeral 4 is the rise of the development theory. The rise of the development theory. Which I had hoped I would have half an hour on this morning. The rise of the development theory. You see, the documentary theory proceeds by itself. Scholars tremendously interested in it, not much interested in the question of when they're written. But very interested in dividing it into documents and knowing what was in this document, what was in that. Because that was being done at that time in all kinds of writing. They were spending just as much time, classical scholars doing it with Homer, and medieval scholars doing it with the Nibelungenlied, as theological scholars were spending in doing it with the Pentateuch. Just as much at that time. But here's a different area that wasn't much paid attention to at that time, and it's the union of this other area with this area, which produced an engine which turned the scholarly world upside down as far as acceptance of the Bible is concerned, and is to this day the greatest force in the world among educated people against acceptance of the Bible as the Word of God. And so Roman numeral 4 is the rise of the development theory. That is, you see the great difference. Documentary theory, we're interested. Is this one book? Is it several documents pieced together? Was one written and then others slipped into it, or were they just fitted together? Now, Hupfeld's idea was, here's the J document, here's the E document, here's the P document. He didn't call it P document, he called it first and second elements. Here are these three different things. Somebody took these three and fit them together, interlacing. That's his idea. That's not the idea they eventually accepted. But we go on now to the development theory. Number one is Divetti. Divetti. Wilhelm Hermann Leibniz-Fuliger Divetti. I tried to look him up this morning in the encyclopedia under Divetti, and then I found under Divetti it said Civetti. So I had to look in a different font. Usually he's put under D-E, capital W-E-T-T-E. But the Schaff Herzog that I looked at this morning at 5:30 said Divetti, C under Vet. Well, now Divetti was a man of tremendous intellect who came from the home of a very devoted German pastor and who had tremendous spiritual feeling, but who became convinced that the Bible as it stands could not be trusted. And the people who tear down people's faith and who do the most to destroy faith are not the out-and-out atheists like Madeline Murray, but they are the people who have a strong Christian background and have a great love for the church and want to develop faith, but don't have faith in the Bible. They get it, they're robbed of it in college or seminary, and then they pass this on to others. And they're the ones who have the great influence. And this young man, Divetti, as a young man in his early 20s, wrote a thesis which won the acceptance of the whole critical world. And his thesis, which he published in 1805, said that the Pentateuch had no history, only legend and poetry, and a few statements like that. That didn't affect people so much. But what he said that did affect them was this. He said the book of Deuteronomy is the book that was found in the temple in the time of Josiah. And so he said the book of Deuteronomy we can definitely date. Look at what Josiah did. He carried out the commands of the book of Deuteronomy. Now he said this book was unknown before Josiah. You read about Hezekiah's revival, he said there's no mention of the book of the law in connection with it. He said this book was just written at that time. Some priests in the temple wanted to have a bigger income. And so he wrote a book to do away with the activities of the priests in the local shrines around the country and centralize everything in Jerusalem. And with this idea, he wrote this book and hid it in the temple where they could find it. And when found, it had a tremendous influence on Josiah, and he carried through that great revival. So he said the book of Deuteronomy in the main, maybe a few parts that are insertions or something like that, but in the main, he said, the book of Deuteronomy comes from the time of Josiah. Now this he said in 1805. And this really marks the beginning of the development theory, although many books will put it under the document theory, because many of these people who believe in the document theory said, that's right, Deuteronomy is distinct from the rest. You don't find much from the JRE document in Deuteronomy. It's a different style from the others, and it definitely is. It is a style of exhortation, not a narrative style like Genesis 2, not a statistical style like Genesis 1. It is a style of exhortation. But they said, and some said, well, if we can date Deuteronomy, that helps in dating the others. But not much attention was paid to that until after Hupfeld's time, quite a little after Hupfeld's time. So this was the great thing DeVecchi did, was establishing to the minds of all critical scholars the date of Deuteronomy. And number two is Vatke, capital V-I-T-K-E, Vatke's little known, far less known than DeVecchi, but Wellhausen, after whom the theory is named, said, I learned more from Vatke than from anybody else. But we have to quit now. I can't have Dr. Fawcett say about me what I said about him. So we have to quit.